It's the archetypal underdog story. Anytime you see somebody winning against odds, the phrase David against Goliath is sure to come up. But how much do you really know about Goliath? Well, I'm here to tell you a bit more about Goliath, and let's start at the beginning with a group we call the Sea Peoples. About 3,200 years ago, over a 50-year period, the Bronze Age world fell apart. We call it the Late Bronze Age Collapse. It took down most of the civilizations of that period, and we're still not entirely sure why it happened. The general consensus appears to be it was a big conjunction of events. But one event that comes up a lot in discussions about the Late Bronze Age Collapse is a group we call the Sea Peoples. On the stele Pharaoh Rameses III erected for the 8th year of his reign, he tells us, "As for the foreign countries, they made a conspiracy in their isles. Removed and scattered in the fray were the lands at one time. No land could stand before their arms. From Hatti, Kodai, Carchemish, Yereth, and Yeresan, but they were cut off. A camp was set up in one place in Amor. They desolated its people, and its land was like that which has never come into being. They were coming while the flame was prepared for them, beforeward to Egypt." Now, Rameses listed a bunch of different groups that participated in that attack and a number of different places they attacked. We know the Sea Peoples were a multi-ethnic and multicultural configuration of marauders. That was very common in the Bronze Age. And, you know, I hope to talk more about those groups soon, but right now we're going to focus on one specific group. They have some pictures of them on there. The Egyptians called them the Pelasate. Now, Rameses defeated the Pelasate in battle, and he moved the captured warriors to the abandoned south-central coast of Canaan, in an area that was still under nominal Egyptian control. And some scholars have wondered, you know, well, why would Rameses give fertile land to a bunch of marauders? This was a very common thing to do, you know, throughout history. It's an imperial tradition. Nobody will protect your borders like the people who invaded your borders. So Rameses was facing war on multiple fronts at this point. He's really stretched for resources. He knows the Pelasate can fight. You know, in exchange for offloading the war on the east to them, he gave them a strip of land that ranged from around modern-day Tel Aviv in the north to the Gaza Strip in the south. And now, he gave it to them, but there were already local Canaanites living in the region. There were also the descendants of some Egyptian slaves who'd escaped captivity a few years earlier. So by the time we get to David and Goliath, the Philistines and the Judeans have been squabbling for around 200 years. Now, where do these Pelasate originate from? First, we're going to take a look in the Babylonian Talmud, where the rabbis talk a bit about the Philistines. And here, I'm going to make a note to my Fedora atheist listeners. I am citing religious texts in this, so I know somebody's going to comment, "The Bible isn't history," and no, the Bible isn't history. Neither is the Talmud, neither is the Iliad, neither are the Eddas or the Rig Veda. All these documents preserve stories and beliefs from centuries earlier. They also preserve details which we can cross-check against the archaeological record and against other stories and legends. You won't get cooties from reading religious books if you're doing it for history. Just keep telling yourself that while you're listening. Now, in the Talmud, the verse, it, book Chulin, part 60b, the rabbis talk about the five lords of the Philistines, the Gazite and the Ashdodite, the Ashkelonite, the Gittite, and the Ekronite, also the Avim. The rabbis ask, well, it said there were five lords of the Philistines, but then Joshua listed six. And you know, Rabbi Yonatan comes in and says there were, in fact, six lords. The greatest were of them were only five. the Avim were not Philistines. They actually, according to the Talmud, came from Teman, which Yemen. And then the verse 8, and the Avim that dwelt in villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim that came forth out of Kaphtor, destroyed them and dwelt in their stead. And what practical difference does that make for us? And then the rabbi says, well, the verse teaches, since Abimelech, king of the Philistines, administered an oath to Abraham, you will not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my grandson, the Jewish people were prohibited from conquering the land of the Philistines until four generations had passed. Then the Holy One, blessed be he, said, let the Kaphtorim come and remove the land from the Avim, who are the same as the Philistines, and let Israel come and remove it from the Kaphtorim, circumventing the prohibition. And now this is really interesting. I hope to get back to the Avim in a minute, but first let's talk about Kaphtor. Rabbis thought Kaphtor was at the far north of Egypt's Nile Delta. Among scholars is that the Peliset actually originated in the area of modern-day Greece at Asia Minor. And so both the rabbis and the archaeologists are right. The Peliset did come from Egypt's far north, but that's where they were captured. They originally came from Greece. Three of the five cities that are mentioned there, Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ashdod, still exist. The present day, Gaza is a Palestinian territory, while Ashkelon and Ashdod are in modern-day Israel. We know the ruins of Ekron, about 20 miles outside of Jerusalem, are being archaeologically dug as we speak. And about 11 miles north of Ekron lies the northernmost and the easternmost city of the Philistines. They call them the Gittites. The city was called Gath. Gath is on the western border of another small feudal kingdom of the time, Judea. When the Peliset first arrived, there was not a king in Israel. The Judeans were ruled by Shoftim, or judges. The last Shofet you may have heard of, Samson, he's famous as the buffest Chad ever to hold Israeli public office. He would have smacked Goliath silly with the jawbone of an ass, but you know, where's the dramatic tension in that? Big guy gets beat up by bigger guy. Instead, Samson meets his match in a beautiful Philistine, Matahari, named Delilah. You've probably heard about that one. She seduces him. He tells her his power's in his hair. His hair gets shaved. He's blinded. Knocks down a Philistine temple. You've heard the story. Anyway, these guys were fighting from the time of the judges to the time of the kings. The Philistines were one of the Jews' most notorious and feared enemies. So what else do we know about the Philistines? I mean, today, Philistine is synonymous with uncultured boors with bad artistic taste. You know, were the Philistines Philistines? And, well, I hate to speak ill of long-vanished civilizations, but I got to tell you the truth, Philistine art was nothing to write home about. You could look at their pottery. It shows an obvious influence in the Minoan pottery found on Crete from the Cypriot ware on Cyprus, but it's as if those artworks were reproduced by the lady who did Monkey Jesus. Then we come to Philistine figurines and statuary. They're equally unimpressive, though I do see some similarities between figures like Ashdoda and the figures you see carved on Greece's Cyclades Islands over 1,000 years before Ashdoda. Still, when it comes to creative art, the Philistines were really Philistines. Though they may not have lived up to their Hellenic cousins when it came to art, the Philistines were formidable warriors. They had bad pottery, but they had some great weaponry. That's what you'd expect from a founding civilization that was involuntarily rehomed and consisted largely of soldiers. Now, we're going to go now to the Bible. 1 Samuel 17, verses 4 through 7, talk about Goliath. They describe Goliath not only as enormous, but as tricked out in a really nice set of Greek armor. I'm going to go on here. Goliath had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. That's 55 kilograms or a bit over 120 pounds. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft is like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. That's close to 15 pounds, and his shield bearer went ahead of him. And this is all what you'd expect from a Greek hero. And now comes the question, how big was Goliath? Well, according to Samuel, Goliath's height was 6 cubits and a span. That's about 9 feet, 9 inches, or 3 meters. The Dead Sea Scrolls of the Septuagint say that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span tall. That's a more reasonable 6'9". It's a little bit over 2 meters. Hafþór Julius Bjørnson, the guy who plays Gregor Clegane in Game of Thrones, is 4 cubits and a span tall, so that will give you some idea of how big Goliath was. And, you know, we knew Goliath was a big guy. Until recently, we really had no idea of how big his home city of Gath was. As we've excavated Gath, we found it was larger than Jerusalem at any time before Jerusalem's modern era. I mean, they may have been uncultured barbarians, but they were a big problem to their Jewish neighbors. This is very interesting, is while they frequently butted heads with the Jews, the Philistines and the Canaanites got on well, and that was surprising. I mean, the Canaanites and the Jews are both Western Semitic. They speak very similar languages. The major difference between them was religious. The Canaanites worshipped a number of gods, while the Jews were, at least in theory, the Jews were supposed to be monotheists. In fact, the Canaanites and Philistines may have gotten along too well. This brings us back to the Avim. The first Philistines are a small group. They're surrounded by Canaanite speakers. And this is not an uncommon situation for Aegean setting up colonies. They handled the situation in a traditional Aegean fashion. They had lots of sex with local women, and they created a second class that was of mixed Canaanite and Philistine ancestry, and this was common among colonies. When the Proto-Greeks did this in Anatolia and modern-day Turkey, they also brought their language and their trading networks with them. A lot of the native customs and languages got absorbed into the larger Greek cultural milieu. But there was no larger Greek cultural milieu surrounding the Philistines after the collapse. And so the locals didn't wind up picking up Greek as a lingua franca, but instead the Philistines picked up the native dialect, and native gods like Baal were especially fond of the Syrian grain and fertility god Dagon. He's within a couple generations their rival. The Philistines were ethnically and culturally almost identical to their Canaanite neighbors. The best example I could give would be the Italian-American community on Long Island. They have slightly different names. They got a couple of customs. They're a little bit different in the religion, but very few Italian-Americans can speak Italian fluently. Very few of them culturally. An Italian-American is closer to a standard American than they are to an Italian, and that's the way it was with the Philistines. Unfortunately, they did preserve one bad Greek habit, and that's the Greek habit of squabbling between city-states. The 5 cities that made up what they called the Philistine Pentapolis regularly fought among themselves, and that made it really difficult for them to push deeper into Jewish territory or to respond to even bigger threats. There were invasions by the Assyrians, and later the Persians. By the 6th century BC, the descendants of the Philistines were completely absorbed into the greater Canaanite population. So what can we say about the Philistines? Well, wasn't the most impressive bit of colonization the Greeks ever pulled off, but, you know, 500 years isn't a bad run for a bunch of Aegean defeated raiders dropped in foreign territory. Philistines give us an excellent example of how groups move around when empires crumble and political order reforms out of chaos. And while we don't know as much about the Philistines as we might like, they're better documented than most of the other what we call sea peoples involved in that war. And while it did happen a bit before the Philistines, we've also got some pretty good information on one of the attacks which immediately preceded the Late Bronze Age collapse. A collapse involved still another band of Greek marauders who raided a city that the natives called Wiliassa and that the raiders called Troy.